Hello everyone and welcome to Rad Chat, the multi-award winning first therapeutic radiographer-led oncology podcast. So welcome to podcast number 23. My name's Jo McNamara and I'm joined by fellow host Namunjoel Canterson.
Hi everyone.
So a big thank you to our last guest, who was Kat Tunnicliffe, who discussed Percy Health, exercise oncology in her role as a physiotherapist. If you haven't had a chance yet, please do go and take a listen. So we're really pleased to introduce our next guest for this evening, Katie Phillips, who's going to be discussing her experience of cancer and her podcast, Talking with the Cancer Podcast, which we have the pleasure of being guests on. So Katie, it's lovely to have you on our podcast.
It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to see you again. When I interviewed you, it was first thing in the morning. And now it's what feels like last thing at night. So we're doing the whole range.
Yeah, we work between the hours of 6 a.m. and about 10 p.m. So, yeah, it's always nice to share it with our guests as to the range of the day. So, Katie, for anyone who has never heard of you before, can you just introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm sure that will be most of your listeners. So my name's Katie Phillips, and I was diagnosed with a rare form of thyroid cancer in February 2022. And pretty soon after that diagnosis, I started kind of like an audio diary, which then ended up turning into a podcast called Talking with Cancer.
Thank you. If you're happy to, would you mind kind of sharing your experience of going through that diagnosis? Can you kind of tell us about your life at that time as well?
So I was 43 at the time of my diagnosis, and leading up to that point, you're right, I'd been running my own business, a PR agency, specialising in the entertainment space, which I set up in 2011. And actually what I was doing prior to my diagnosis was I was going through an IVF journey. So I was about a year and a half into IVF, fertility treatment with my husband. And I'd taken like a bit of a break, and in that time I actually developed a cough. But what was going on alongside all that, just to throw more madness into my life, was I was having a loft renovation at the time. And so this cough that I had, it felt like there was always something kind of in my throat, and I was convinced that it was the building works that we were having done at home. So this cough was quite persistent. It was particularly bad if I lay down. So at night it would come on, and if I was laughing, or you know, I'd sometimes find myself choking. So there was something definitely going on in that like respiratory area. And then I discovered a lump, kind of on the left side towards the back of my neck. And at that point, my husband was like, you need to get this looked at. What is wrong with you? You know, he'd been nagging me for ages. So I would say the cough I'd had for about three or four months, the lump on my neck did actually grow. So it started off probably like the size of a grape when I noticed it. But how often do you notice your neck? You know, I think that's the thing I've realised, like check your neck is, yeah, it's pretty important actually. So that was kind of the background, really. So it grew from the size of a grape to probably like the size of a strawberry. That was in quite a short space of time. And so that was really at the point where I went to see a chest specialist to say, look, I think I need to get my cough looked at. Do you think this lump is related to the cough? And I was getting sort of mixed messages in a way. But the chest specialist I went to see acted pretty quickly. So then what followed was sort of the tests and the diagnosis.
Was it quite quick?
Yeah, I mean, look, I won't lie. You know, I went through a private health insurance. My husband's work provided us with Bupa, and that was an absolute godsend. So I went to see the chest specialist, and he pretty quickly, I would say in about a week, it was about a week from when I went to see him to when I had lots of different tests. I had a fine needle biopsy, I had scans, and it was actually at the biopsy where the radiographer said, you know, because he was doing an ultrasound all around my neck, and he said to me, this doesn't look like it's a chest issue that you've got. He said, you've got an abnormal thyroid. Has anyone ever you know, have you ever had any thyroid issues? So I said, no, I've been on a tiny bit of thyroxine because I'm on a fertility journey at the moment, but never had any thyroid issues, never had any health issues my whole life. Was really healthy, you know, quite into kind of wellness and nutrition and stuff like that. So the length of time, it's a little bit of a blur, but what happened was my chest specialist then said, you don't need to come back and see me. I've referred you to an ENT doctor. And he specializes in thyroid and he's going to see you with all your results. So I went in to see him, never met him before. I was actually on my own. My husband was away working. It was the 15th of February, 2022. Everyone remembers their diagnosis date, don't they? And he said to me, listen, what you've got is malignant. And I said, sorry, could you tell me what that means? I knew full well what it meant, but I was just like in so much shock about it. It was just the last thing I expected. And he said, it is cancer, but we don't really know what type of cancer. We can't really figure it out. It looks like a thyroid, but we're not really sure. So we need to do further tests on your pathology. So he was really sweet. He said, look, I don't want to worry you, so let me do the worrying. And I sort of said, they think I'm really not going to worry from here. But he was always really clear, like when he would get back to me and what he needed to find out. And I think it was then about 4 or 5 days later that he called me and he said, look, we know what it is. He said, you've actually got a rare type of thyroid cancer called Hobnail. And we're going to need to do further tests because basically what I know now, which I didn't really understand then, was that it had metastasized a lot. So the cough was actually, so what was happening was the thyroid cancer was traveling through my lymph node pathway and the lymph nodes in my airway were big and blocking the sort of airways into my lungs. So sorry, not in the airway, in the trachea. And those lymph nodes were blocking the airways into my lungs. Plus, there was a lot of cancer in the lungs. So they had to rule out whether it was lung cancer as well. So I had to have lots of further tests after the diagnosis.
Katie, for anyone who has never had a needle biopsy, ultrasound guided, they are not the nicest, most pleasant diagnostic tests, are they? I think we do focus on that treatment and the after effects, but it sounds like your pathway specifically to actually get a full histopathology was really challenging. What was going through your mind? Like, I'm also thinking about the people around you and the fact that you were, although having a break from IVF, that must have been on your mind as well.
Yes, it was. I mean, look, it was kind of strange in a lot of ways. On the one hand, I was very used to being in a healthcare system and dealing with doctors. I'd learned through the IVF to inform myself as much as possible and, you know, ask questions and make suggestions. I think that was a big learning for me with IVF. And I was lucky that my fertility doctors, in the same way actually that my oncology team, were open to my inquiry, you know, and would sometimes kind of say, oh, that's a good idea, or that's a good question. So I was kind of in that space. So I was able to like ask questions and self-advocate a lot. The biopsies, you're right, the fine needle, I mean, to be honest, that was better than the core biopsy, which was, I won't lie, probably the worst procedure I've had throughout the last few years. Do you know what? I don't know. I think it was all a bit surreal, Joe. It was like kind of shocking, kind of surreal, going through the motions, didn't understand why this was happening to me, how this was happening. And I think when you're in something, you're kind of in it, aren't you? It's the anticipation that's often a lot harder. And then it's the post-trauma that's kind of harder. But when you're in it, you just get on with it. You know, you've got an appointment, you turn up, you have the procedure. It's, you know, I remember coming out of the core biopsy one and I was sort of shaking because it was so traumatic. She went into she went into the thyroid and she went into one of the lumps 5 times with this sort of plunger thing. And it was pretty horrific. Sorry, that might be a bit too graphic. When I came out, I was shaking. And I said to my husband, that was so awful. That was so awful. That was the worst thing. He said, okay, it's done now. It's done now. But it was like, it was pretty grim. Yeah, pretty grim. So that's the thing. I think you just get on with it. And then it's afterwards, really, that you kind of realise what you've been through.
How quick was it to start treatment afterwards?
So what happened was my team, who had diagnosed me and done all those tests, didn't know what to do with me. They were very freaked out. By the time they had the CT scan results and they called me in to meet with them, they sort of sat me down in a very morbid way and showed me this scan result, which was just lots and lots of red lights lit up. I had so much cancer. I mean, they couldn't understand really how I was still alive in a way. They were like in shock. And they said, look, what we think is best is to refer you to the Royal Marsden. They deal with rare cancer. They'll probably know how to deal with this. And so I then almost had to start again. I went to the Royal Marsden, they had all my results, but obviously they want to run through those results. They want to, you know, it's not just like an easy, okay, here's a handover and off we go. So I remember that my diagnosis was the 15th of February, like I've said. I started the treatment on the 22nd of March. So I kind of knew I had cancer and I was waiting. It was about 6 weeks, which was horrific. That waiting period was horrific. But my oncologist at the Royal Marsden said, she said, I know you're going to be really wanting to start your treatment, but it's so important that we get this right. Like, more important than anything, we need to know what we're dealing with. We need to get your treatment right. So what they actually diagnosed me was this hobnail, this rare form of thyroid cancer. But what I had was a ROS1 fusion with that. And the ROS1 fusion is the mutating gene that was somehow turned on and caused the cancer. But the bit that they couldn't really figure out was that ROS1 is found in lung cancer. It's found in, I think it's called non-small cell lung cancer. It's never seen in thyroid cancer. So this was all, this made my case even stranger. And actually, I was then treated by the lung oncologist team at the Royal Marsden initially. That's initially who kind of, led my treatment plan.
What treatments did you have, Katie?
So what they did was they put me on a targeted treatment, or a TKI, as they're called. And it was quite a new one. It was only FDA approved in 2019. It was called Entrectinib. And that was in the form of a pill that I was given, you know, a bottle of pills to take home and take every night. So I had a 600 milligram dose. So I took 3 orange pills every evening. And what was really interesting about that is that within about 4 days, the cough started to clear up. So I knew that this is working. And then I had these, you know, these lumps, and I could sort of start to feel as they were reducing. So I knew that the treatment was working. Yeah, I knew that it was. I was pretty confident it was working.
Science is amazing, isn't it? Just what we've been able to achieve in such a short amount of time, really. I mean, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, so what you had in immunotherapies in general, it's just amazing. Obviously being a bit biased talking about the Royal Marsden, but still, it is an amazing
product. Yeah, incredible. And I think that's the thing. A lot of people said to me when I got my diagnosis, treatment now is amazing. There's so much they can do. And in a way, it was reassuring. It's not always that helpful because people are sharing all sorts of things when you get diagnosed, and often it's more confusing, you know, and it's more conflicting. But they were right, and it is true. Like, it's incredible what treatments are out there and what's available now. Just amazing. So what happened was the Entrectinib worked pretty quick. It ended up shrinking about 23%. The size of the cancer. And I was then put forward for surgery. Prior to that, the surgery would have been too complicated. So the tumours had shrunk enough that they could operate. And I started on trectomy in the March, and then in the July I had my surgery. And I had a full neck dissection. I don't know if you can see, your listeners won't be able to see, but they basically went from underneath my right ear all the way down, across and up to underneath my left ear. I had a full neck dissection and a thyroidectomy. So they took out my thyroid, and the surgeon, who was amazing, actually removed 100 lymph nodes from my neck. So what they discovered was that, I mean, I think they literally had like a bucket. Sorry, that sounds really gross, but they had a lot of lymph nodes and 85 of them had cancer. They also did something incredible during that surgery. They called in a thoracic surgeon from the hospital down the road at the Royal Brompton, who came in and from my neck went down and cut out some more lymph nodes that were in my airway, in my trachea. So that meant I didn't have to have a full, what they wanted to do was cut me open down my chest as well. And it meant that I didn't have to go through and have that, which was incredible. So that was the surgery. During that time, I came off the entrectinib. It's not advised to have surgery while you're on it. And I was on a 6-week break from the entrectinib. And what I did sort of 4 weeks after the surgery was I went to have radioactive iodine. And that's a very common treatment path for thyroid cancer. I know, Joe, you had thyroid cancer, didn't you? So I don't know if you were treated with radioactive iodine. You're basically in a room in isolation because you're radioactive. You take a radioactive pill. It's just a little pill. You just take one. And then, yeah, you're sort of stuck in this room for 4 days. And in honest truth, that was probably the worst treatment of all the treatments I've had. Because you're in a little room, no one can come and see you. I didn't know my surroundings. I had a tiny window. It was miserable. So that actually was not effective for me. You go and have the scan sort of as soon as you're released from the room. And the scan just shows, has the radioactive iodine actually gone around to the cancer? And mine didn't. So I'm actually RAI refractory, so radioactive refractory or resistant. So that was a bit of a waste of a weekend. Then I went back on the entrectinib, which worked, continued to work. The scans, I was having scans every two or three months, and it was showing sort of stability or slight kind of reduction. Because obviously there was still quite a lot of cancer left despite this surgery. And then what I found in the January was some progression. So they put me on a different TKI. They switched me to lenvatinib, which is quite commonly used for thyroid cancer. And I struggled with that a lot. I didn't find that easy at all. I had quite bad side effects from that one, actually. And that sort of worked for about 6 months. And then they switched me to another one. So I'm on my third TKI, or targeted therapy, and I'm currently on cabozantinib. So I've been on that, for about 6 months. And after 2 months on that treatment, I got a completely clear scan, which was just the most unbelievable result. And something, I mean, my oncologist called me to tell me. I had an appointment to see her on the Thursday, and she called me the day before and just said, look, I've got to tell you some amazing news. Like, there is no disease. Like, there is no sign of disease. I was like, what? What? I was just like, I love you. I was like, I want to hug you. It was just, yeah, incredible. And then you just want to share that news with everyone. So that was amazing.
That must be a highlight of an oncologist's whole working career, to be able to share that news with a patient that they've been treating. It must just be incredible.
Do you know what? I really got the impression that she was just thrilled. It was just so lovely. And it's funny because I phoned one of my nurses, one of my CNS, to tell her, because I wasn't sure if she'd have heard. And I know she's in a different hospital. And I phoned her to tell her because she was so happy. And she was so thrilled. She was like, that's made my day, Katie. I'm so pleased. And you realise you're right, Joe. Like, and obviously, you know, because you're on that side of things, like, wow, you know, they were absolutely thrilled. And my oncologist was thrilled. And when I saw her, I gave her a hug, you know, and it was just, and she, you know, even now, because I just had another scan, which showed it was clear again. And that was sort of 5 months after the first one. She was just like, I'm so pleased. I'm so happy, you know, which is just so lovely.
How are things now?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, it's been nearly 2 years since my diagnosis. I think it's amazing. And obviously, you know, you go on this journey and it feels like a big, big challenge. And it feels like a lot of trauma, but at the same time, a lot of learning, you know, and a lot of self-discovery and all, you know, all sorts of things happen in this time. So I think it's like I was saying before, I think there's a lot to process in a way, and I probably am really processing that. I mean, look, I'm still on the treatment. You know, my team feel that I've got this ROS1 fusion and that's been turned on and that will never be turned off. But I keep saying, I just think it's all gone. I just think it's all gone. And I'm on a clinical blood trial for circulating tumour DNA. So that is a 2-year trial. And that's to, instead of look at your a biopsy of a tumour, it's to look at any tumour that's, any tumour DNA that's in your blood. So it's kind of like a quicker, easier way, really, to check for tumour markers. I mean, again, you guys probably know more about it than I do. So I'm very keen to unravel that side of things, but that's typical of me, trying to be a bit impatient and jump the gun. So I just have to stay on the treatment for the foreseeable, basically.
Katie, what drove you to want to be involved in clinical trials and research?
Well, they asked me. I know, I think there's about 200 patients around the country on this trial, and I jumped at it. I think that whatever I can give back is just so, so important. And it's like we were saying, you know, what the way that treatment has evolved is incredible, and it's thanks to these brilliant brains of these scientists and these labs, but it's also, you know, you need the patients to really understand how you can progress treatment. And so anything they want, I'm there, you know, I'm really happy to help in any way I can.
Katie, so the podcast, an amazing podcast that you started whilst you were going through treatment, tell us a little bit about it and how did that help you as you were going through your cancer pathway?
So like I mentioned earlier, I sort of started an audio diary. It was very soon after my diagnosis, I had this sort of gut reaction, which is that I've got to talk about this. And I asked a friend of mine, Claire, if she would mind just recording a conversation over Zoom. I think what was going on as well, which I think is really common, is that as soon as people started to find out, I got inundated with messages and phone calls and emails, and it was all really kind and loving and caring and thoughtful, but incredibly overwhelming and actually quite stressful. You know, everyone responds in a different way when they hear about something like this, and sometimes that sticks and it's great, and other times it's like really, really difficult to deal with. So I just thought, if I go through everything in a conversation with Claire over Zoom, I can then send that out to all this group of people, friends and family who want to know what's going on. So that was what we did. We sort of sat down and chatted for like an hour over Zoom, and then I sent the recording out. And anyone that got in touch with me, I would say, listen, I've actually recorded a conversation. Are you interested in listening to it? And they were like, yes, definitely. And we just kept doing this. And after a couple of months, I said to Claire, how would you feel if we just put this out as a podcast? And she was like, sure. So that's what we did. And the first series was, it was week by week account of my journey. And her just, you know, a good friend. It was like two good friends having a chat and it was all about me. And then that sort of evolved a bit. And in the second season, we started interviewing people. So she would interview someone or I would interview someone. So she interviewed my husband. She interviewed my mother. I interviewed my oncologist. I interviewed the doctor who diagnosed me. And it was all, you know, it was a bit of a mix. And then Claire was very busy with her own life, understandably. And I just started doing the podcast on my own. And every week I would interview a different guest, whether it was someone from the Institute of Cancer Research, whether it was a yoga for cancer expert. I've spoken to a dietitian. I've spoken to a death doula. I've spoken to a grief expert. It was kind of wherever I was going in my life on this journey was kind of what I was bringing in as the subject for the podcast. I ended up probably recording about 70 episodes. And it's been fascinating. I've learned so much from doing that. And what I hope it is a resource for other people. You know, we've obviously chatted on there. I forgot to mention in my treatment path, I did have radiotherapy as well. So that was great that I discovered you guys, because I, you know.
How could you forget that bit, Katie?
Come on a radiotherapy podcast and you miss out on the radiotherapy.
You know what? This is also why it's been brilliant that I've recorded everything, because it's so easy to forget, but I've got it all. I've got a record of everything. And, you know, my husband would sort of say, is this like your memoirs? And I was like, no, it's my living diary. This is not about a legacy. I mean, it is a legacy, but it's not about once I die, it's there forever, you know. Because, listen, you know, there was a lot of the direction that I was going in was like, this is really serious and we don't really know the outcome for you. So I didn't want this podcast to be about, oh, it's there for, you know, when my day comes. And it wasn't really about that. So I found it incredibly cathartic. You know, I was in therapy at the time. I've been in and out of therapy for years, but I started to feel like I was kind of saying the same thing to my therapist as I was saying on the podcast, because I really did. I gave it my all. And unlike you guys, who are incredibly organized and prepared, I used to just sit down and press record each week when I was talking about myself. Obviously, when I interviewed people, I did prep. And I did my research. But for myself, I didn't plan anything at all. I would just sit in front of the microphone and talk. And that was very, very therapeutic, I have to say. So, yeah, I'm really glad I've done that. It's on a bit of a hiatus at the moment. I've got one interview that's lined up with Lauren Mahn, who was one of the hosts on You, Me and the Big C. So that is coming out in March, which I think is when this is coming out. So yeah, and then I might pick it up again and do more. I don't know. See, I really enjoyed doing it, but you know, it's quite a lot of work, isn't it? Like, you know, even if it is just like sitting down solo and doing it, it's a lot of work and it costs money. And you know, I'm so proud of the body of work. And like I said, I may well do more, but yeah. I'm glad I've done it. Very glad.
So unfortunately, the cough came back and I started the lenvatinib in the January. And within probably a month or 6 weeks, I was coughing again and it was bad. It was really bad. It was probably worse than the time just before my diagnosis. So even though I was on the lenvatinib and it was sort of working in some places, there were other parts that it wasn't working. And my oncologist said, look, I think that a lot of the cough is being caused because you've got one of these cancerous lymph nodes that's kind of blocking the airway into the right lung. And if we zap that with radiotherapy, just one treatment, I think it might be effective. So that's what we did. I went to sort of get measured up, if you like. And it's very, very precise to the millimeter measurement where they initially take the pictures and find the actual spot that they're going to treat. And you come away with a little tattoo. I was very excited about that because I'd never had a tattoo before. A tiny, tiny freckle of a tattoo. Mine sits almost central in my chest. It feels like a real center point in my body. I'm very proud of that little tattoo. And then I went back the following week, had the treatment, which takes 5 or 10 minutes, and then it's done. I think what's strange about that is quite how impactful that can be in terms of side effects. And I felt very, very tired for quite a long time. I would say a couple of weeks. I slept a lot and I was quite confused. I called my nurse and said, do you think this is normal? And she said, yes, because not only have you had the radiotherapy, but you've still stayed on treatment. And so your body's dealing with a lot. And I think it took a while to work. It doesn't work straight away, does it? So over time, my oncologist could see on scans, you know, that this had been effective. I think it did help with the cough to a degree. But ultimately, you know, I was taking codeine syrup. I was trying everything. And it was really only when I started the new treatment, the cabazantinib, that the cough fully cleared up.
Hi, everyone. So we wouldn't be able to do what we do without some sponsorship and help from some amazing people. So we've just got a short advert here coming up, just so that you can hear some of the products from one of the sponsors that have supported us right from the start.
We have an incredibly exciting time at OSL at the moment, with new products within our portfolio coming to the market. One new product is ClearSight Bolus, completely translucent, semi-adhesive and compatible with surface-guided radiotherapy solutions. Another product is the IBA Microwave Proactive System, the only commercial prospective risk management solution for radiation oncology. You'll find much more information about this on our website.
If you would like to browse our products, please go to our website at www.osl.uk.com, or if you would like to speak to us, please call 01743 462 694.
Katie, can I ask a question that you may not feel comfortable in answering, so it's absolutely fine, but given everything you've been through, have you kind of thought about kind of children because of what you were on that pathway trajectory for kind of starting all cancer treatment?
Yes. So I have a stepdaughter, a gorgeous stepdaughter who's 16. And, you know, therefore I have got a role as a stepmum. It's definitely not a mum, but it's, you know, it's a lovely role and we've got a lovely relationship and we, you know, she spends a lot of time here at our home. And so that's really special. So I would say that I feel very blessed and lucky to have that. I will not proceed with IVF. Definitely not. I really grieve that, you know, the idea of being a mother and having a child. And other times I think that's just not my destiny. Other times I think it might be.
Oh, thank you for being so open and honest with this. And obviously I can appreciate that is a bit of the crux of cancer, isn't it? Because you are still on a treatment pathway. You are still kind of making sure that you're having the regular scans. And it's time consuming. It takes up a lot of space to then add other treatments. And, you know, you do get some form of, even if it's not diagnosed post-traumatic stress, even being in a hospital environment brings back so many memories, doesn't it? And, you know, I would imagine going through IVF is part of that as well, in having to kind of put yourself back into that environment where it's so challenging and having to have another team that's kind of managing you.
Yeah, I mean, I've got no science to back this up, but I wouldn't be surprised if the IVF had something to do with the cancer. Something turned on the ROS1 gene, you know, and I was injecting myself with synthetic hormones. So that's sort of, it's one of those things, I think, when you get a diagnosis, you're desperate to know why. Well, I was anyway. Why? What's caused it? It wasn't a kind of why me question. That's not really my vibe. But I wanted to know what had turned on this gene. Like, how could I discover what that was? And the thing is, you can't. But that's sort of a bit of an assumption. And so I just wonder with the fertility world and the fertility industry, you know, do they really do their proper checks and balances? Because that's a whole other podcast. But yeah, you know, listen, like looking after yourself and having cancer, even if you're clear in NED, it is takes up so much time. I'm someone who is very, very much across all of my medical team. Sorry, that's Monty, my dog, growling in the background. He features on my podcast a lot, actually. It takes up a lot of time, and I really learned that I had to be across everything, you know. And the other thing I think that maybe doesn't get talked about is sort of what you're left with. I'm left with hyperparathyroidism. I had one of my parathyroid glands removed, which is very common in head and neck surgery. You have four parathyroid glands that are the size of a grain of rice, and they sit around your neck or thyroid, and they control your calcium. So what they really do is they use vitamin D to release calcium into the body. I think that's right. Again, you might know more about that than me. And we all know that calcium is important. And vitamin D is important for bones and muscle. But actually what the calcium is also important for is your heart. So, you know, I have to have calcium medication for the rest of my life. I have to be monitored. My calcium levels were also affected by the cancer treatment that I was taking. That was bringing them down. And I ended up in ICU for 4 nights because you have to have your heart monitored while you're on an IV for calcium. So I've got that. I'm on thyroxine for the rest of my life because I don't have a thyroid. But again, that's amazing, you know, that you can take a drug that replaces a hormone, an organ. That's just incredible. So you're left with loads of things. And then there's this sort of strange identity thing, you know, like I'm a cancer patient, but I don't have cancer, but I'll always have cancer. But will I always have cancer? So there's all of that, you know. And I always found it fascinating, actually, when I was in the throes of it. How do you transition out? You know, when you do get the all clear, if that is your outcome, what do you do then about, like, your identity and stuff? Because you've just sort of got used to this. My friend said to me, she said, having cancer is a bit like when you're pregnant. Like, for all that time, you're famous. People treat you like you're famous. You know, they offer you a chair. They open a door for you. They take you to appointments. And then suddenly you're sort of forgotten. I mean, she's a comedian, and she was obviously kind of joking. But, you know, there is a strange period of adjustment, I think.
I think that's a really good analogy to use. I can definitely see that. You get that support, don't you, from lots of people. And then, you know, you go through treatment and everyone expects, well, that's it now. You're fine. Or, you know, or you're not fine, but I don't want to keep asking or being intrusive. And so, yeah, I think that's quite a good analogy to use. I can really see that. Katie, we've come to the end of the podcast. It happens all too often that we've got about 110 questions that we wanted to ask you. We'll have to do a round two. But we always end Rad Chat with top tips. So have you got any top tips for our audience?
I mean, I do think the self-advocacy one is huge. That keeps coming up. And I get asked, like, how do you self-advocate? And what's difficult for me to answer that is that it's in my natural skill set, if you like, to just kind of like manage people. I think the best place to start is getting contact information for your team and knowing that you've got particularly like an email address for them and making sure that you can share test results with them or that they're sharing test results with you. I think one of the big things is understanding. People say, no, you're normal, but what does that really mean? It means knowing what are your blood test results for all the different bloods you have to do. What is right for you? You might be in a range, but where do you sit in that range? And then you can kind of see, okay, something's off. These bloods show me it's not quite where I'm used to being. And get to know it yourself. Don't just take from your team, oh, your results are fine. Yeah, your bloods are fine. What does that mean? So I think it's sort of really getting to understand your biology a bit and how your body works. And that is part of self-advocacy, because I think you have to be across your test results. Keep a file, keep a folder. I kept an email folder in my inbox. I called it Getting Rid of Cancer. That was what I called it. Because I wanted it to have, you know, a positive title. It wasn't like a cancer inbox. It was, you know, I'm getting rid of this. And keep on top of it. I think that's really important.
Oh, amazing advice. Thank you so much, Ketty, for coming on the podcast. You've been amazing as always. And thank you for sharing everything that's very personal to you. It's very much appreciated. So thank you all for listening to Rad Chat. Your host today have been myself, Jane McNamara, and Nam and Joelka Anderson. If you're utilising this podcast for CD purposes, consider the reflective questions posted along with links to the resources and literature that we've discussed. To receive your accredited CPD certificate, please complete the Google form linked with podcast. Our next feature will be Judith Nepetol, who will be discussing her experience of cancer in the community group she founded. So thank you for listening and take care.